I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. You've seen their signs, bright green, red, or yellow billboards, as you're driving down Broadway or Main Streets in Kansas City, Missouri, or along State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. Check cashing businesses are all over the place, even in the suburbs. Today we'll find out why more and more Americans are turning to check cashing companies for services that used to be the bread and butter of traditional banks. Then, one of Kansas City's most accomplished jazz trumpet players is back from Europe, and he's gigging around town, supporting a new album that is just fantastic. You don't want to miss my conversation with Herman Mahari. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, it's been a big week in Missouri government, in Missouri politics, and joining us now to run it all down for us is Brian Ellison from KCUR, host of the podcast State House Blend Missouri. And Brian, thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure to be here, Steve.
Yes. What's happening in Missouri this week? What do you want to highlight?
Well, a couple of big things happened yesterday. The Missouri House passed the Transportation Network Companies Bill, the Uber Bill, as it's often called. As you know, this has been pretty controversial. They tried to get something through last year and couldn't. But once Kansas City and St. Louis came along, the cities got satisfied that the cities would have enough control. The Missouri House passed it with an overwhelming 140 vote vote yesterday, and it looks like it's headed to the governor's desk.
I was going to say, this thing's been hanging around for a while, this controversy. It's been tough for a lot of people to work through, even here in Kansas City.
Well, it has, and the companies, Uber in particular, have invested an enormous amount of money and resources into the General Assembly there in Missouri to see something get passed. But it looks like both Uber and Lyft will be ready to be fully operational across the state.
What else is happening?
In the Senate yesterday, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program bill, which, you know, this has been kicking around for several years as well.
Missouri's the only state in the country that lacks one. This helps pharmacists make sure that they don't prescribe too many opioids to any one person across the state.
That's right. Essentially, it's a database that pharmacists and doctors would use, and theoretically, at least, it would sort of tip off medical professionals that a person is receiving too much of the drug or getting it from multiple sources. It is credited by many professionals with stopping opioid abuse in many other states. But as you said, Missouri is the last one to adopt such a plan. Representative Holly Rader, a Republican in the House, has been pushing for this year after year. It got through the House. In fact, it's gotten through the House several times, but it always has been held up in the Senate by Senator Rob Schaff of St. Joseph, a Republican who's a physician himself.
And his concern was that what people's personal information and personal privacy would be violated by this new law.
Yeah, it's been interesting to hear his objections as a physician, not really trusting his fellow physicians and others who would have access to the database to have all of that. He came around, though, last week and said that he is now okay with it. He had a few things he wanted to change. And yesterday, in hours of debate on the Senate floor, they went very late for a Thursday. He made sure it had all the language that he wanted in it. But then it ran into more trouble with other privacy advocates, including Senator Will Krause, the Republican from Lee's Summit.
Right.
They made some amendments that will purge the database of information after 6 months instead of 2 years, which is what the sponsors wanted. So now they did pass the Senate eventually after hours of debate. The vote was 22-9.
But it has to go back to the House
now with
work
all
it
of
out.
Those amendments. And so Holly Rader says she's hopeful that it'll pass, but she's not. She's checking with its advocates.
Do you have any sense at all whether Governor Greitens will sign a bill like this?
Governor Greitens has not come out clearly in support. Certainly, he has not come out clearly in opposition either. I would think if it can eventually pass both chambers with a pretty healthy margin, he has not indicated that he would be opposed.
I also noticed that Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill has been making the rounds across the state. She was in Parkville yesterday for a town hall meeting. She swung by the Kansas City Star. What can you tell us what she's talking about, Brian?
Well, she's been fielding questions on a lot of things, and one of the things she did in her appearance in Parkville is take aim at her fellow members of Congress and senators who won't hold town halls, Republicans in particular, as you might expect. She can't believe that they won't do that, but she spoke out. She said she was surprised. The most interesting thing I thought, Steve, was when she said to reporters afterwards, she was surprised she didn't get more questions about foreign policy. She sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate, and I think it's very intriguing to find out that that people aren't interested in those questions, even at a time when that's very much in the national news.
It always is interesting at those town hall meetings. You know, you don't get a lot of foreign policy questions. It just is too removed from too many people's lives, even though those questions obviously are so darn important.
They are terribly important. You know, one other thing that happened this week wasn't actually on the floor of the legislature, but did happen in the governor's office. Governor Eric Greitens made a Facebook statement yesterday. This is how he makes most of his announcements, through social media, where he announced the reversal of some longstanding administrative policies in Missouri in support of what he calls religious freedom. State contracts previously could not be awarded, including social services contracts, to organizations that were affiliated with a church or religious organization. He has changed that, so it'll be interesting to see what kind of response that gets.
I was going to say the ACLU has already come out very much in opposition to what the governor has proposed yesterday, and you can only imagine lawsuits are going to be flying over this issue.
Yeah, and religious freedom, as that term has come to be used, generally is referring to providing more opportunities for religious organizations to receive federal funding, or state funding in this case, and it does not appear that the ACLU had previously gotten involved with this issue here in Missouri, because I don't know that anyone saw this coming. So this we'll see where this all plays out.
You know, Brian, just a final thing, going back to Senator McCaskill making her way around. I wrote a column today for The Star talking about how the rural vote will be so important for her reelection. She's been emphasizing that in press releases and in official statements, and really trying to push the idea that she has the countryside very much in mind as she makes her way around the state. Prognostication here. How do you see her reelection prospects at this point moving into 2018?
Well, that's a great question. I think certainly if the results in the Kansas 4th District this week are to be trusted, that was good news, even though the Republican won. That was good news given the swing of Trump voters for the Democrat in the Kansas 4th. If that sort of thing holds up in Missouri, and of course that rural-urban split is a truism about Missouri politics as well as in the Kansas 4th District, that's probably good news for Senator McCaskill. You will see, I think, in the next 18 months, every opportunity she has to find common ground with rural voters, with moderate to conservative voters. If she can do it while not being hypocritical to positions she has taken in the past, she's going to take those opportunities.
That's a tightrope she's walking. She's got to win 42-44% depending on the county and at least be competitive with Republicans. So we'll see how that plays out. KCUR's Brian Ellison giving us an update here on Missouri government and politics. Brian, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Steve.
And joining us now, KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. She wants to talk about Kansas City looking at some tough decisions when it comes to the future of the Buck O'Neill Bridge, the former Broadway Bridge, downtown Kansas City. Lisa, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I'm very happy for you to be here, as we're trying to ad lib here just for a little bit before our first guest joins us here this morning. What condition is the bridge in right now, Lisa?
Well, the Buck O'Neill Bridge was built, you know, more than 50 years ago. It's a 60-year-old bridge built in 1955, and what happens is it's just reaching the end of its life cycle. So the city council had a presentation yesterday about exactly what the reality is, and you know the joints that are holding the bridge together are they're beginning to see the end of their life there. The river floor is eroding around the piers.
Right.
There's the underside of the bridge is rusting, and sooner rather than later we're going to have to deal with what to do next, and it's not an easy solution there.
I was going to say, what options are on the table? Because so many Kansas Cityans depend on that bridge to get back and forth from work every day.
Right, right. The city says, more than 50,000 people drive over that bridge every single day. It's a state asset, but MoDOT is just cash-strapped right now, the Missouri Department of Transportation, and they said they can only put $50 million into it, which would rehabilitate the bridge, which would, make it safer. But it doesn't fix any of the traffic issues. The people that sit, on that bridge, for an hour each day commuting from the Northland. And so that's, it's a solution. It would extend the bridge's life for about 35 years. but it doesn't fix some of the other problems there.
How do the mayor and city council, what are they saying about all this?
Well, they're pretty split on it, because the other option to rebuild the bridge and fix those issues is $150 million, you know, price tag on it, and that extra $100 million has to come from somewhere. Mm. And the city council members, they're looking at options to see how the city can maybe come up with some of that money. But there's a big division there, because, you know, there are council members that are staunchly opposed to using city dollars for a state asset.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you watch the infrastructure needs of our community of Missouri and Kansas, I'm always struck by these single individual items cost so much money. You wonder about the abilities of cities and states and the federal government, for that matter, to manage these things going forward, given the cost being as huge as they are. Kansas City obviously just passed this $800 million bond issue a couple weeks ago. That'll extend for 20 years or 40 years, depending on how you want to count it. But that's only a fraction,
of the needs of this community
when it comes to infrastructure.
Yeah, and, you know, Kansas City passed that bond, you know, I think trusting that that would go to city streets and bridges and sidewalks. And so to use that money taxpayer dollars on a state project is, you know, it's a little controversial among the council.
So what happens now? What's next on this whole thing?
Well, right now, the council has, you know, they're taking under consideration a resolution just to explore the options. How could, you know, in the event that we want to rebuild, where does that money come from? How much of it is from the city? How much can we get from federal grants? And just to see, you know, put all the options out on the table.
Okay, that's KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez giving us an update on the Buck O'Neill Bridge, the former Broadway Bridge in downtown Kansas City. Lisa, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll visit with one of Kansas City's great young jazz stars, Herman Mahari, who has his debut jazz album out. We'll listen to a lot of that and talk to Herman about his rise in the jazz world. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we toured the attractions along Kansas's I-70 and explored the difficulties that older rural men face when they decide to come out. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate or go to the NPR1 app. On Monday, the Smart Money experts return to examine the financial gender gap, and they'll give us some tips for improving your physical fitness. That's Monday on the program. The Smart Money experts are back. Herman Mahari is out with his debut album, and that seems a little odd because Herman has been a trumpet mainstay on the Kansas City jazz scene for a few years now. But if it's a debut, it's one heck of a debut. Titled Blue, the CD includes a stellar cast of players. They include Logan Richardson on sax, Aaron Parks on piano, Peter Slam on vibes, and Ryan Lee on drums. Herman Mahari came on the scene a few years ago with the band Diverse, and he's on the scene right here with me now in the studio. And welcome back. So good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Sounds good.
Appreciate it.
How do you feel about it?
I feel really great.
Now that you're listening to it.
It feels good. It's nice because it's an album I know I'll still be proud of, you know, 10 years from now.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Well, how could it be, you know, Herman, that Blue is just your debut album? I mean, I had to read that twice when I looked at the cover of the disc that said all that, because you've been around a while. What took you so long?
Yeah, you know, I've been doing and still am working with Diverse, but I felt ready as to put my name out and as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt musically ready to put my own personal statement out.
How big of a step is that for a young player when you put out your debut album? I mean, you obviously want this to be something significant.
Yeah, it's a really huge step. I kind of been telling people at this point, you can now search my name on Spotify and I have an album, you know, or Apple Music.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's huge. It's especially for I've had a career for, you know, over 10 years now, maybe longer than that.
Yeah.
And I don't have an album or name, but now I do. So it's
I was going to say, when did you begin thinking about this first one? Maybe it was like 20 years ago, but when did you begin thinking about this album and what you wanted it to say and who you wanted it to be, who you wanted to be on it with?
Well, you know, it was in the back of my mind for a long time, but the concept of it came to me within the past maybe year and a half or a couple of years.
Concept being?
What I wanted it to sound like and the kind of players that I wanted. And then the album kind of showcases that my diversity of styles that I like,
mm-hmm.
the music. And the kind of melodicism I enjoy in other players like Aaron Parks and Logan Richardson and Peter, I wanted the album to not have any moment that wasn't exciting or melodic. And
you know, a couple of these players, you got Aaron Parks and Logan Richardson. These are guys with national reputations now. How do you corral guys like that to be on a debut album for Herman Mahari?
Well, that's part of it. Is, you know, I've had this career, so I've been playing with other people and have built in my name. So that kind of helps, you know, like there's some backlog there and Aaron heard me play before and really, he enjoyed my playing and wanted to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
And Logan and I've had a relationship for a while.
Because Logan's a Kansas City guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Just how big has Logan Richardson gotten these days? I mean, his star has shot high.
He has blown up and rightfully so. I've been a champion of his music for a long time. I really feel like he is the innovator on the improvisation and the saxophone, like on that front of this day.
I think you described him once as the guy you most looked up to in the entire jazz universe. He was that important to you a couple of years ago when I read an interview that you had given. He's that kind of guy.
Absolutely. He's a big influence on me and a big influence on why, you know, part of why I keep doing the music, why I get excited about it.
Yeah. So when a young guy like you wants to make a debut album, I mean, do you have to get together the funds yourself? Are people approaching you to make an album like this? How does that work?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be approached by a really great guy, Dan Edwards, and he's got this Record Rebuild Jazz LP project. And so he helped me get funds for this. So we kind of worked on it together in that regard.
Yeah, and so you recorded it here in town?
Exactly, we recorded it at Sound 81 Productions.
Yeah. What kind of leader are you? I mean, how did that process unfold of you leading a band through the different charts? You had some originals here, some some from others. How did you lead your band through this thing, Herman?
Well,
the best thing about this group is that they're all top-notch musicians. And when I put and arranged the music, I had all their voices in mind. So, you know, when we got together and rehearsed it, there really was not much I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had valuable input in the studio and how we could do certain things here or there. And my philosophy has always been to let the musicians do what they do. I hired them specifically for a reason.
You know, I'm always amazed at that story that, you know, Miles Davis, the way he put together Kind of Blue. It's the seminal jazz album, the most popular jazz record. You know, it sells millions every year, you know, 50, 60 years after it was made. And he basically walked Bill Evans and Cannonball and John Coltrane into the studio and said, give me something that sort of sounds like this, and gave him a few hums, and off they went. And suddenly, here's this album, which continues to be this enduring masterpiece. Is that sort of along the lines of how you do it?
Exactly. Miles has always been a big influence on me, not just on the trumpet, but, you know, in the way he had his bands work. And if you look at all his bands, his first great quintet, the second great quintet, all the fusion groups, he let the musicians do what they did, and you hear the result of that because it was his trust in their voice.
Yeah. I've always been struck by your playing, because your playing strikes me as walking down the road of the way Miles Davis plays, you know, and you're not a Freddie Hubbard, you know, the flashy high notes and the crazy solos that go on forever kind of thing. And I'm wondering, as a young guy, were you tempted? Did you want to be the Freddie Hubbard early on? And at what point did you say that a different path might be okay for someone like yourself?
I don't think there was like a significant turning point or anything. I think it just kind of naturally was also part of my personality. That's not how I am, so it's not how I would present my music.
Mm-hmm. It just didn't feel right to be anything other than what you are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Were you but you're a young guy, you want to show off a little bit. I mean, but you know, not that you can't now.
Yeah.
But it's not what Freddie used to do.
No, and that's, you know, like, that would never be the intent. But if it was, there's other ways to do it, I think, in more subtle ways, too.
Mm-hmm. You also strike me as interesting, Herman, because trumpet guys are known for big egos and the guys who want to, you know, sort of be large and in charge. And you aren't that kind of guy either. How does that work for you?
It translates to how I play the trumpet. One of the things that I hear from a lot of other musicians when they hear me play is that they appreciate that factor in my playing. It's that my sound is maybe not as brash or
your face.
I'm consciously thinking of that every time I'm playing. So, I mean, that's just how I am and my personality in real life.
And it's really set you apart and given you your own distinctive style just by being who you are, which is what you got to do in jazz, right? That's the whole trick, is not to be somebody else, but to be who you are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Was that hard for you to wrap your arms around, or did it come naturally to you?
It came naturally, and I know it doesn't always for everyone, but to me, I didn't really go through like the, they talk about like assimilating other players and stuff. I've definitely studied everybody and I've listened quite a bit, but, it just came for me just being particularly deciding what I liked and didn't like about other players. And then that, you know, ultimately defines what I like, you know, what I want to sound like.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another track off of Blue here. Again, your debut album. This next track is titled 11-13, and there's a story behind it. Tell me about that.
There's a story. So that's named after the Friday that the terrorist attacks. I was on tour in Paris, and
the day the Paris attacks, you're talking about.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I was there when it happened. Me and Peter Schlamm, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And
Did you hear them? Did you hear the bombs going off?
No, we didn't hear the bombs. We were more closer to the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't hear the shooting. We first heard the sirens and stuff.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
What's going on? You know,
you knew something was happening.
Yeah, and everybody huddled around TVs, and we had no idea what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's different when you're there and you don't know what's happening. And you're just like, it was, you know, very scary. But at the end of the night, it was less scary and more just sad. So this song is a tribute to those victims.
Okay, this is Herman Mahari from Blue. The track again, 1113. That's Herman Mahari, his new disc, Blue. That track titled 1113, it's in tribute, I guess, to the victims of the Paris bomb attacks a few months ago. Whenever a host lets a song play that long, that means the host likes the song a whole lot. Herman, that is just terrific. I should point out that Herman Mahari will join Crystal Warren for a benefit concert for Jazz LP. That's a group transforming a vacant and abandoned neighborhood on Kansas City's east side into a creative hub. That'll be at 7 o'clock Wednesday evening at the 1900 building. That's at 1900 Shawnee Mission Parkway in Mission Woods. That benefit for Jazz LP Wednesday evening at 7. You know, as you grew, you're talking about other trumpet players that influenced you. Do you have a list of three or four or five trumpet players that would be on your list of the all-time great ones?
The all-time great?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everybody that's generally acknowledged as being on the list would be on my list, but
yeah.
If I was to pick personal favorites off that list,
yeah,
it would be Louis Armstrong. Clifford Brown, and and of course Miles.
Yeah.
In terms of guys who've passed, but in terms of contemporary, I think Ambrose Akamusir.
Yeah.
He's a really big influence on me.
Who's been here a few times? Yeah, I've seen him several times.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
And he's personally, he's helped me really see things differently musically. And
can you articulate something like that?
Yeah, we sat down for coffee in New York at this point maybe like 7 years ago or 8 years ago,
he was really something.
Yeah, he was on his upward trajectory. Think he had already won the Hmong competition at that point, but he kind of shifted my focus of my goals. He kind of, when we talked about just now about how I've figured out what I am musically, my sound and everything, instead of having just a broad idea of getting better at playing music and jazz, he made it more narrowed by making me decide specifically the things I like, things I didn't want, like write them down. And so it really narrowed my focus and,
Focus on the things you like and let some of the rest of it go.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me develop musically a lot quicker because everything made more sense. It had more purpose.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it frustrate you as you grow in your career? It frustrates me sometimes. Like I listen to that track 1113. I just think it's just so magnificent. You know, that jazz continues to struggle the way that it does. And, you and Diverse and your own crowds at gatherings at Blue Room have been pretty spectacular. But still, you know, the whole scene continues to sort of struggle in some ways.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it's more stigma than anything. It's this music is all over the world. I'm playing it with people all over the world, and there is support for it around the world. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's an enduring music. It will be here for a long time, forever.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when we talked a couple of years ago, you were in the process of moving to France. Are you living in France? Is that your home now? Is Kansas City your home, or you got two homes, or where are you?
I'm spending more of my time in Paris nowadays than the States.
Yeah. So. Why?
There's a lot of opportunities that I'm getting in Europe, and so it's a little bit easier to make myself more available for these opportunities. And I've been kind of developing things over there on that side for a while now.
There's a long tradition of jazz artists from this country winding up in Europe, and people say that the Europeans appreciate it so much more over there than it is here. I'm thinking about everyone from Art Farmer, who played trumpet, Ben Webster, Dexter Gordon. Do you find that to be the case today? Do you see Americans sort of saying, okay, I'm going to go give it a run in Europe?
There's been some notables recently. We talked about Logan Richardson. He lives in Paris.
Yeah.
The great bass player Joe Sanders lives there. That's just two examples. Kurt Rosenwinkel lived in, he might have moved back to the States recently, but he lived in...
Guitarist, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He lived in Germany in Berlin for pretty long time too. Mm-hmm.
And the appeal for you, you're getting lots of work, and what else? I mean, the people, do they appreciate it more? Is that your sense?
There's definitely a bigger appreciation for it. It's kind of instilled in the culture, I think. That's why there's more festivals in France for jazz than there are in the States, which is, kind of weird to think about, but there are.
It's American music.
Yeah, it's definitely American music.
And it's doing better over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just one country, you know.
Yeah.
There's all those countries are next to each other, and they all have lots of festivals and concert series and... You know,
you came on the scene a few years ago, Herman, with Diverse, the band. That's a group of UMKC grads or jazz study students who came on the scene, and you guys really made a splash. You won some national competitions, and suddenly you were on your way. That group's still together?
Yep. Me and Ryan and Ben are the core. Ryan Lee and Ben Leifer are the core of the group.
When are you guys playing again here in town?
We don't have anything booked right now.
Right.
Part of that's my fault because I've been so focused on this project.
Other stuff. Yeah.
It's right now, life for me is kind of balancing between these projects.
Yeah.
Deciding, kind of going the flow, which one is at the moment more pressing.
You know, a couple of years ago, you finished first at the prestigious Carmine Caruso International Trumpet Competition at Sam Houston State University down in Huntsville, Texas. You won $10,000. How does it feel to win something like that, win first place in an international competition like that?
It's, one side of me, to be honest, is not into the competition aspect, but it's more of a necessity because we, in this industry, we kind of have to take what we can get. Mm-hmm. But the other side is it's extremely validating. It's really cool that they really liked what I have to offer and believe in what I have to offer.
And they thought it was good, even though it wasn't the high crazy stuff, the Freddie Hubbard stuff. It was something that was very much Herman Mahari.
Exactly. I played like myself.
How important is it to get that kind of affirmation as a young artist, trying to get up the ladder a little bit?
It's really great. In the jazz world, you kind of get your affirmation not from like becoming a huge star, but from your colleagues and peers who believe in what you're doing. Yeah.
So it can be hard to come by or a long time coming for some people.
It can be. Yeah. So it's, in that sense, I was put on on the international stage and in a test, and I was, it was, they approved of it.
Nerve-wracking?
I would be lying if I said I wasn't nervous, but I have done a number of these competitions at this point, and I think I got to the point where I said,
okay,
I'm just going to be like I'm playing with my homies,
I'm going to go do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to play another track off of Blue, Herman Mahari. This track is Awakening. Herman Mahari, Awakening, from his new disc, Blue. Why did you decide to play the trumpet? What is it about the trumpet that grabbed you?
I picked the trumpet right before 7th grade when I was joining band in middle school. And I tried a bunch of instruments out, and it's the one that spoke to me the most. I felt it.
Did it come to you naturally? Did you progress pretty quickly?
I did, but it's hard to, you know, honestly, it's hard to draw the line between whether it was the natural or my work ethic. You know, I was really, I really enjoyed practicing and playing. So
yeah,
I was, if it was natural, I was definitely helping that.
Are your parents musicians?
No, not at all. I've no music. That's kind of a weird thing, but yeah, there's no music in my family.
How do they feel about you going off and becoming a jazzer?
Very, very proud. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit a different path for my family. My background is Eritrean. My parents from Eritrea, and so I'm first generation American.
Yeah.
And you know, most people who come from Ethiopia or Eritrea and come over here, like, they're, you know, they want their children to be doctors or lawyers or whatnot, and I kind of, you know, the black sheep in that sense.
Did they hesitate when you told them what you wanted to do or not?
No, because it was pretty natural. I mean, I was doing well in school and stuff, and
yeah,
there was a point where they're like, well, you know, are you going to do something else too? And,
Nope, this is where I'm going. This is it. Well, I should point out again that Herman joins Crystal Warren for a benefit concert for Jazz LP. That's a group transforming a vacant and abandoned neighborhood on Kansas City's east side into a creative hub. 7 o'clock Wednesday, 1900 Shawnee Mission Parkway in Mission Woods. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It'll be a lot of fun. And speaking of people who've made the move to Paris, you know, like Crystal Warren is also living in Paris.
No kidding.
Yeah, and she was she went to school at Paseo like Logan did. So
yeah,
they're, you know, Logan and yeah, Crystal are there. So,
well, congratulations on the new disc, Herman. So good to have you here. We'll be watching you closely. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the Kansas City Royals are off to a rough start, but what can fans do about it? What should they do? Simply wait it out? Well, yeah, sorta. Commentator Victor Wishna explains in this April edition of A Fan's Notes.
The season had barely started and alarms were sounding. The Kansas City Royals opened in Minnesota and promptly got swept by the Twins, by far the worst team in the league last year. They showed some life in Houston, but capped the trip off with a painful extra-inning loss. And then it was on to KC, where they dropped their home opener to the bottom-dwelling Oakland A's. Indeed, it seemed as if perhaps the Royals' collapse was a season ahead of schedule. The only bright spot might have been all of Salvi's home runs and his new day-glow blonde hair. But so what if the Royals were the last team in the majors to win a game this year? So what if they're coming off their worst first week in more than a decade? Baseball, like no other sport, preaches patience. Work the count. Wait for your pitch. Lay down the sacrifice. Trust the next guy to get that runner home. When even the best batters get on base less than 40% of the time, failure isn't just an option. It's to be expected. Moment to moment, week to week, and year to year, baseball is a waiting game. It's why recent efforts to speed it up, like the new no-pitch intentional walk, seem to fly in the face of its essence. Baseball has its share of hot young stars, but it's also the only major pro sport where journeyman minor leaguers can toil for years and still get their shot. Compare that to the NBA or the NFL, once branded the not-for-long league. Of course, Royals fans know about patience, following a generation-long playoff drought. But I'm not talking about that often delusional hope of, well, there's always next year, but the patience that pays off when you give a good team just a little extra leash. For example, while Casey's offense has stalled overall, the power is surging, with homers soaring at an unprecedented pace. New Royal Brandon Moss, who didn't have a single hit through almost six games, finally delivered with a tie-breaking ninth-inning blast. Of course, the bullpen would blow that lead, as it has multiple times in these first 2 weeks. Wade Davis is gone, Kelvin Herrera sprung a leak, and the new guys have struggled. You know what they say, sometimes you've got to walk before you can run, and sometimes you just walk in runs. But promising lefty Matt Strom has already been sent down to Omaha for fine-tuning. Coaches think they've found the problem, and help is on the way up. Meanwhile, veteran Joaquin Soria has shown flashes of the brilliance that twice made him the Royals' lone all-star during his first stint with the team. Without a doubt, there's a dramatically different feel to this season. No longer defending champs, the Royals must shoulder a different burden. Just look at their shoulders, where the World Series patch has been replaced with a small black strip that reads Ace 30. In memory of Yordano Ventura, the fiery young pitcher who died in a January car wreck at the age of 25. Instead of a ring ceremony, this year's home opener featured a tribute and a solo saxophone rendition of Amazing Grace before Ventura's mother threw out the ceremonial first pitch. Indeed, this year's going to take a new kind of pride and perseverance for players and for fans. Not complacency, but a real patience that requires persistence. The idea that we're going to win precisely because we're not going to give up, even if it takes a while. That's a lesson baseball fans know. That's worth sharing with anyone who, right now, might be feeling a little hopeless or helpless or fatigued. You take one day at a time, and there are 150 games to go. Take it slow, it'll work itself out fine. All we need is just a little patience. Set sugar, make it slow, and we come to... Victor Wishton is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's program, the Smart Money Experts examine the gender finance gap and will give us some tips on getting fiscally fit. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Steven Steigman, Chris Pruitt, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. We won't